Hello and welcome to a Brave Space podcast with Dr. Catherine Meeks, the executive director of the Absalom Jones Episcopal Center for Racial Healing, and I am your host, Chelsea Glasgow. How are you doing, Dr. Meeks?
I am well. How are you today?
Excellent, excellent. Great. I have a very exciting topic that I think may have been... We haven't really talked about this because we've been so focused on the 400th year anniversary. And so I wanted to bring this up because and see how the connection between the 400th year attached to the Red Summer of 1919. For those of you who do not know, the Red Summer occurred in 1919 from May to October. So that was about 6 months of back-to-back massacres that occurred in several cities across the United States. The states in Texas, Virginia, South Carolina, Arizona, New York, Chicago, Washington, D.C., Mississippi, Georgia, and so many others. This occurred as a white response to labor shortages, migration of Black people, and the idea that Black people were just advancing a little bit too much and taking a lot of whites' jobs. So can you elaborate a little bit more on what happened in the Red Summer of 1919?
Well, it's really a pretty amazing thing to think about. The 300 years after the start of slavery that we should have this kind of thing happening. And it's so tragic and sad. And I've just come back from being in Elaine, Arkansas, where in 1919, there were 230-something people massacred there, which was maybe not in the summer, but it was a part of that whole spirit that was flying around across the United States of thinking that somehow Black people needed to be put back in their place.
Oh, yes.
Because the notion that if you were a Black person, you had a place that didn't have to do with equality, and that if you were rising up economically and kind of getting a little bit of status, then something had to be done about that. And Black people were able to come together, pool their resources, build economic stability for themselves in a lot of places. And that was the frightening thing. And of course, people were leaving the South, too, during that time, looking for a better way to live. As Bryan Stevenson has said, they were trying to escape the terrorism of the South. And so they were really refugees that were, we think about them as migrants, but they were actually running from a state of being that, you know, being in a place where you weren't safe. And so with all that happening, with all that movement and with Black folks getting their legs under them more, I think it just was too frightening for the white supremacist spirit that thought it was supposed to stay in power and stay in charge. And here these folks were looking like they might actually be able to move up the ladder. And, you know, when you can go from slavery to a little bit of economic stability, that looks like you've gone maybe a lot further than you have just because you started at such a low place.
Mm-hmm. It seems like the confidence that Black people received after fighting side by side by white people in World War One, and when they came back, they understood, wow, we have power. And if we've been fighting for America, surely when we get back to America, we need to be treated as if we are equals, because at that point they are, as they always have been. And it also seems, you know, as I was doing my research specifically for Elaine, Arkansas, it was about the sharecroppers, right? And the sharecroppers were organizing. And again, that was just a little bit too much power, a little bit too much resourcefulness by Blacks. And so they were attacked. That happened 100 years ago. You said you recently visited Elaine, Arkansas. 100 years. Have you seen any progress from what happened 100 years ago in the Red Summer till now?
Well, the first thing I want to say is that I'm from Arkansas, and I grew up in that region where this happened. I grew up about 30 miles from where this happened in 1919, though I was born a lot later. And my father was a sharecropper. I picked cotton in Arkansas. So I know a whole lot about sharecropping and how repressive and oppressive that system was. And if anybody's doing it now, it still is, because you are basically a glorified slave. Mm. And the sharecroppers were not actually organized yet. They were meeting to organize. Mm-hmm. And so just even the thought that they might try to come together and pool their power was enough to create that kind of response. And so the white folks organized themselves and went out and started killing people, and they killed over 200 people, maybe 250, the count's hard to come by. But the sad thing for me, being back there this past weekend, was that Elaine, Arkansas is like a place in the developing world. It is just, there are no grocery stores, there's no school, there's no infrastructure to support a community. And there are about 500 or 600 people who still live there. And so it's a very sad place. It's very sad. And it was very traumatic to be back in that space and see that kind of blight. And then Helena, which is just about 30 miles from Elaine, which is where the marker was actually placed to remember the massacred, is again a small town in, you know, the Mississippi Delta, but it's thriving. I mean, they've got businesses and banks and schools and all the things that you need to have in a community in order to have a community. So, and there's this big divide between Black folks and white folks there that you can just feel. I mean, it's, I don't know if they feel it because they live in it, but because I came in as an outsider, I could just really feel the divide and how the Black people are kind of in Elaine having to try to assert themselves as being, having some power, and the white people in Helena that were doing the marker were having to, you know, it's like, well, we don't have to be bothered with you, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was the kind of undertone of about the whole thing. But I have to hasten to say that it was also important for that marker to be placed and to be placed where it's placed, because a lot of what happened, the white folks who went out to kill the people met in the space where we were sitting, wow, where the marker is placed. And so that's significant.
Yeah.
And that's an powerful, important thing. And it's also important for the white people in Helena to have to pass by that marker day after day and remember what it's about. So I understand both sides of the coin, but it still was traumatizing.
Yeah, that sounds pretty traumatic, especially since, you know, living in Atlanta, we don't see as much of that divide or feel as much of that tension, even with the rich history that Atlanta has with Black history and civil rights and the civil rights movement, et cetera. So my question now is, with that marker being placed there and that memory, you talked about how that memory is very important for people to be able to recognize what happened and to move on and to see and dream about a better future. Now, if we were to connect that memory with the memory of the 400th year, how do those two relate to one another, if they do at all?
Well, I think they do relate, and I think that the issue is that when you start with a system of dehumanization, which is what slavery was, then there's nowhere to go but down. Mm. And down led to being able to have folks go out and just kill Black people, because after all, this is a denigrated group of people. And if you're thinking of people as being less than, it doesn't bother you much to think of harming them. So there's such a direct correlation between selling those 20 Angolans in 1619 and killing over 1,000 people in 1919. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's almost like a straight line. And for me, the line continues into the 21st century with all of the other, the prison industrial complex, the death penalty, the police extrajudicial killing. It's the same kind of energy system. And that's what I really cannot stress enough. And I really hope people will start thinking about, so we stop thinking that there's just, we can pick pieces of this and fix it. If we keep thinking about it in this holistic kind of way, then we understand what we're up against, and we understand what the work needs to look like, as opposed to thinking, you know, it's like, well, if we just go plug up this hole, it'll be okay. Well, you plug up the hole, but then there's half of the pipe is broken down the road. So if you don't go fix that, you're still in trouble. So I really think that the connections are just profound.
Yeah, it seems like this just continuum of consequences, right? From 1619, we made this huge mistake as America. And ever since then, we have been paying for it with our lives, pretty much, with the peace of mind within our communities. In so many ways, it has negatively affected us. What is the Center for Racial Healing doing about educating the community? And what is the message that you believe that our church parishes should have, that bishops should be preaching and ministering? Do they need to focus more on talking about the Red Summer or the 400th year or at all? How can we move forward?
Well, one of the major themes that kept being said over the during the placement of this marker while I was in Arkansas was that this is a beginning. Placing this marker is a beginning. And I like to think about activities like that being an interruption of negative energy. So we have to keep on being committed to interrupting the negative energy. That's what we've done with the lynching memorials. That's what I see the Equal Justice Initiative doing with the way they're approaching us dealing with lynching. We have to stop trying to sweep things under the rug and pretending as if we can just all get along. I mean, that's just the most nonsensical analysis to make about the situation. We have to be willing to look the history in the face and then to ask ourselves, now, where do I stand here? And what do I need to do? So anytime we do any remembering of the 400th year, of the Red Summer, of anything, we have to be always saying, but it's just the beginning. This remembering is the beginning. We are remembering so we can take another step forward toward working for liberation. And we have to be working for liberation for everybody. I think that white people have missed out on understanding how much oppression, their oppression, their commitment, their complicity with oppression has oppressed them. And so everybody is in this together. We've got to figure out how to get each other free.
Yeah. And it seems like on this continuum, as we continue to put these daggers in history, put these markers in history that recognize what has happened and also progressively moving forward. One of the things that just came to mind is the Women's Conference that is coming up. Can you tell us a little bit about that? The Women of Color and Wellness.
Well, to sort of connect that with your previous question about what is the center doing, the center is completely focused on always making spaces where people can engage this conversation and in a brave way, and engage. And bravery is about telling the truth and being honest and facing the facts and not trying to sugarcoat it or make sure that everybody leaves without any feathers being ruffled. Those are not things that we find ourselves preoccupied with. We're preoccupied with, are we compassionate and are we telling the truth? And the International Women of Color and Wellness Conference that's coming up in a couple of weeks is about making space for women of color to come together and talk about ways in which oppression and marginalization has hamstrung them and how we share that as sisters. And we have women coming from Latin America, from Ghana, from our Native Indigenous women. We have worked really hard to make sure that we have representation. So we've got Native Indigenous women coming and participating as speakers, women who have been rescued from prostitution and trafficking, along with the bishop from West Tennessee and an Indigenous woman from New Zealand, and then Latino women and African American women. And white women are invited and welcome to be present, but they have to understand the conference is about women of color. And that's, I think that it's one of those really important moments for us to be bringing these folks together this way and having these conversations about power and wellness and health and how we can use our intuition and our skills and resources to create spaces where women around the world can catch a glimpse of how we can work better for liberation.
Yeah, I think what's so interesting about having women from all around the world have this one conversation about marginalization, about being disempowered, about all of these things, and how there seems to be this silver lining where everybody connects, no matter where you are in the world. Is that one of the hopes of bringing all of these women together?
Well, I think that and also one of the things that happens to oppressed people is they get polarized by the master narrative of that you're separated. You know, women in Latin America, women in Honduras, the Dominican Republic won't think that their situation has anything to do with women in North America or in Ghana. Women in Ghana will think that their situation has nothing to do with women in New Zealand. But the truth is, all of us have that same kind of repressive, marginalizing energy that we're struggling against. And even somebody like Bishop Phoebe Rolfe, who is the new African-American bishop in the Diocese of West Tennessee, she knows about marginalization. So does the woman who has been rescued from prostitution. Mm-hmm. So we share that in common, even though we've got this bishop and a person who was on the street. The common thread here is you're a woman and you're a woman of color and you're marginalized. Mm. And so when we start really understanding that and standing in that place together, it increases our power. And that's why oppressors have always used as a remedy, keeping the oppressed thinking that they don't belong to each other, keeping the oppressed separated. You know, the Latinos against the blacks and the Native Indigenous people against the blacks, or this group against that group. That's all you have to do if you're an oppressor, is keep people destabilized and not connecting with one another. As soon as we start connecting, just think about what kind of power we have. So.
Wow. I think that's really profound, because in a lot of millennial circles on a HBCU campus, I have heard people saying that, you know, well, black people have to stick together, right? And Chinese people have to stick together, and Asian people have to stick together. And all of these different groups who experience the same marginalization in different ways, in different systems. And you're saying that no, we need to come and connect and maybe learn from one another's oppression and help one another get out of that system where they are continuously marginalized and put down.
Yeah, my son likes to call it Oppression Olympics.
Oh, really?
That we need to get over our desire to have Oppression Olympics, where my oppression's worse than yours and we're the most oppressed group on the planet. The truth of the matter is, if you're not free, you're not free. Mm-hmm. And a lack of freedom is the thing that we share in common. And anybody who is struggling against oppression needs to understand that the other people who are struggling against it puts us all in the same boat. And it's not necessary for me to have to prove that because I'm a black woman, my life is worse than a Native American woman. I mean, what's the point in that?
It's no point.
That is the master narrative. That whole superiority, inferior thing. So you got to have superior impression, oppressed, and inferior oppressed. I mean, isn't that ridiculous?
Yeah.
So the point is that if I'm not free and you're not free, that's all we need to know. And we need to come together to say, let's see, is there a path to liberation? Then let's see how can we get on it? How can we help each other? That's the other piece for me, is how can we help each other? Because that's another way that oppressors keep us down, by making us think we can't help each other. Mm-hmm. And so what this conference is going to be about is saying we are a powerful body and we can help each other. And we're not doing it like regular conferences. We're having speakers and we're having storytelling times and sharing times, and we're having no workshops. We're having self-care breaks, where women will go to the meditation room or go to Thistle Farms, which is the organization that has worked with rescuing the women from trafficking and prostitution, and go to the bookstore, go outside and walk the labyrinth, go have a break. Because what we want to model is the necessity for making time for people to connect. And it's in that space that healing can happen, and people get to know each other a little bit, and you go back to your home base with a set of experiences that are really different from somebody just talking to you for 2.5 days. Though we will do some talking and singing and dancing and have a lot of good food to eat, but we are clear about the path to wellness and health being a path that includes connecting and developing relationships and hearing one another and really listening to each other.
Yeah, it sounds like this conference is going to be so phenomenal, not only because where else can you go and experience so many different women from different places, not just around the country, around the world, and with all of them simply having the desire to get well, to be liberated. And that sounds like that is the core. Everyone who comes there, regardless of what experience they have had, they are coming there to get well, to figure out how they can help their communities get right. well.
Right. And that's been a big part of the focus, too, to say we hope you will go back to your community rejuvenated and inspired, and you'll be able to share with other women. So we've kind of been a little bit pushy about make sure you send somebody who's just not a total introvert. Mm-hmm. So when they go back, they'll be able to actually assume some leadership, because yeah. this is not just an event. I mean, I don't do events. What we do is activities that help to push our work forward. And there's always a plan. And it's always about, everything is about going forward. We've got a vision. We're trying to go somewhere. And these things help us to get there. We're not just entertaining ourselves.
Yeah, it's way more than entertainment. It sounds like this is going to be educational. This is going to be empowering. This is going to be bridging the gap between women of different cultures, different places, different mm-hmm. stories. This is going to be interactive. Mm-hmm. This is going to facilitate experiences that you will remember right. forever.
And reaffirming that though we bring all of those diverse pieces into the room, that it's one story, that we are one group of people. We are one people. We are connected to each other, even though we have come from all these different planes on this earth. And when we start really internalizing that concept, we will treat each other better, and we will work more diligently, I think, to create a world where everybody can be who God put them on the earth to be.
Yes. So our listeners, if you guys have heard about this Woman of Color and Wellness Conference and have been inspired just by this mere conversation, can you imagine how much more you will be empowered and inspired if you actually come? So Dr. Meeks, can you tell us when this event is, what time it is, how can we sign up, how must we go forward?
It's October 24th through 26th at All Saints Episcopal Church. Go to the Center for Racial Healing website, and you will find all of the information that you need in order to register. And if you need to have a scholarship, please email me and talk to me about a scholarship, because we're not trying to have anybody miss this conference because of money.
Right. Right. Definitely. So definitely, if you have been, again, inspired by this conversation, we hope that you will make your way to their website and register, 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 and bring a friend, a notepad, and yourself. And we are going to be very excited to see you there. Now, Dr. Meeks, I hear that you have finally released your book on Ida B. Wells, and so that is available from Church Publishing on Amazon and in bookstores. Will that book be available at the conference?
Yes, it will. And okay. the Cathedral Bookstore is going to host a bookstore the whole time of the conference. So
excellent!
I'm excited for the Ida B. Wells book to be available for people to purchase there, but also, as you've just said, from the bookstores as well.
Excellent. And one last question before we go. We talked about the Women of Wellness and conference, and we also talked about the Red Summer. Would you say that this conference is, again, putting another, what is the word that I want to use? This conference is making more moves to bridge that gap that that was settled in 1619.
I think it's an interruption of negative energy.
Yeah.
I mean, I think for me, that's the most profound image that, and it's not mine. Somebody said it to me, so I want to give that somebody credit. But it's such a profound image to think about that if you're interrupting negativity, you're doing something. Mm-hmm. You're not fixing everything. You're not changing everything. But there's a negative stream of energy that got weaker because mm-hmm. you interrupted it. Mm-hmm. And if you do that enough times, if enough people do that all over the globe, then the energy becomes destabilized. So mm-hmm. that, you know, it gives you hope mm-hmm. that you're a little sitting at by the ocean with your little spoon dipping. Eventually, if enough people are doing that, mm-hmm. we end up making a dent.
Yes. Listeners, I hope you guys are encouraged to be disruptive in this system and participate in things that will continue to interrupt that stream of negative energy. So that's all that we have time for today. However, if you want to keep this conversation going, please visit us on our website at www.centerforracialhealing.org. You can also stay connected with Dr. Meeks on Facebook. Dr. Catherine Meeks, please like her page and you'll stay updated and all of the moves that she is making in the country. You'll be able to purchase her book and again, register for the conference. Until next time, just remember to continue to tell the truth.